Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Dr. Robert Lustig. Dr. Robert Lustig is professor of pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology at the University of California, San Francisco, and the director of weight assessment for UCSF's Teen and Child Health Program. He's author of Fat Chance, The Hidden Truth About Sugar, Obesity, and Disease. Nearly 7 million people have watched Dr. Lustig's provocative YouTube video, Sugar, The Bitter Truth. His groundbreaking quest to understand the scientific underpinnings of sugar addiction has been featured on 60 Minutes and most of the major news outlets of our times. Dr. Lustig has authored more than 120 peer-reviewed articles and trained more than 50 other health professionals. He is featured in the provocative and groundbreaking films Fed Up and Sugar Coated. So now, Dr. Lustig, my dad and I are so glad to have this time with you. And now for the interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Well, thank you, Ocean, and thank you, Rob, for being with us once again. It's a pleasure to bring your voice to our audience.
My pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Sugar once was something we added to coffee and tea, we baked cookies with, we consumed it in limited amounts, and maybe even more importantly, we had control over how much we added to the foods and the beverages we consumed, so we knew what we were doing. Now, things have changed. We don't know how much we're eating. We don't have control over how much is in our food. It's added to peanut butter and salad dressings and pasta sauces and supposedly healthy choices, things like fruit-flavored yogurt. And well, it's really added to just about every packaged food that's sold in just about every supermarket in just about every city in the country. I'm thinking about vitamin water, for example. It's sold as a supposedly healthy beverage. But a 20-ounce bottle of vitamin water contains as much sugar as 3 Krispy Kreme glazed donuts. Sugar now comprises something like 18% of our total calories. We're consuming at least 25 times more of it than our ancestors did. So what I want to ask you, Rob, is do we even know what this huge increase in sugar consumption is doing to our lives and to our health?
Well, we do, in part because of what's happened over the last 40 years in terms of the obesity, diabetes, fatty liver disease, you know, this whole metabolic syndrome pandemic that has occurred. Now, I am not going to tell you that sugar is the cause of metabolic syndrome, but it is certainly a cause, and it is a manipulable cause. It is a preventable cause. Based on our data, we have calculated that 29% of all of the type 2 diabetes in this country is due to sugar and sugar alone. And across the world, 25%. And you know that there are countries that are diabetic without being obese, such as India, Pakistan, and China. And the question is, if obesity is the problem, how come these countries that are not obese have such a high prevalence of diabetes, higher than ours? And the answer is because it's not about the obesity, it's about the sugar. The way we need to look at this, instead of looking at sugar as its calories, we need to look at sugar as an environmental insult. In the same way we look at, say, BPA, and the same way we look at alcohol. It's not because of the calories that alcohol carries with it. It's because of the alcohol molecule itself. Well, the sugar molecule, specifically the fructose molecule, the molecule that's sweet, the molecule that makes us want it, the molecule that makes us crave it, has some very specific properties that ultimately impact our metabolism, our brain, our health, and ultimately our society. And as we've come to understand this molecule better, we've been able to basically pinpoint at least one, if not the major cause of disease in this country.
Well, if I understand your findings accurately, total caloric consumption really doesn't correlate that much with diabetes prevalence worldwide, but the correlation is absolutely staggering between calories coming from sugar and diabetes incidence. Is that an accurate summary of your findings?
That's exactly right. We did a study, it's called an econometric analysis. This looks at availability of specific calories within countries across the world and across time. So the Food and Agriculture Organization statistics database, that's part of the WHO, computes the number of calories per day per person in every country on the planet, 175 countries total, going forward year after year after year. So this doesn't give you the snapshot. This gives you the movie. This gives you the time analysis. And what we did was we looked at the different kinds of foodstuffs, grouping them. So total calories, of course, fruits excluding wine to look at, you know, fruit that is sugar with fiber, meats, cereals, fiber-containing foods, oils, dairy, and finally, sugar, sugar crops, and sweeteners as line items. Moving forward from the year 2000 to 2010, what we found was that if an extra 150 calories per day were available in any given country, diabetes prevalence went up a total of 0.1%, which is nothing. But if those calories happened to be a can of soda instead, diabetes prevalence went up 11-fold to 1.1%.
Wait a minute. I want to make sure I'm getting this and that our listeners are. Are you saying that on average, if a person increases their daily caloric consumption by 150 calories, there's little rise in their diabetes risk, but if those 150 calories come from a can of soda, their increase in diabetes risk is huge?
We've computed that in our country, in America, our current average consumption of sugar, which you rightly said was 19 teaspoons per day, increases our risk for diabetes by 68%.
Which is staggering, you know, and I'm thinking about children right now. I mean, and kids are, we have something called type 2 diabetes. That's, of course, the most common form of diabetes by far. It used to be called adult onset diabetes because it occurred in adults. It didn't occur in young people, but it does now. In fact, although teens with type 2 diabetes used to be unheard of, and we called it adult onset diabetes, now a third of all new cases of type 2 diabetes in the U.S. are in teens.
Exactly. This is a disease that had never occurred in children. I started my medical schooling in 76 and became a intern in 1980, and we had never heard of pediatric type 2 diabetes. In fact, I actually went into pediatrics originally to stay away from chronic disease. And now that's all I take care of. When you look at the fact that children now get two diseases that had never been seen before, type 2 diabetes and fatty liver disease. If you got fatty liver disease before 1980, there was really only one cause, and it was alcohol. And children don't drink alcohol. So fatty liver disease was unheard of in the pediatric population. Well, a paper that came out in 2006 says that 13% of all children who die from other causes when they're autopsied show fatty liver disease, and of course 38% of obese children, and that is only going up. So when you really think about it in percent increase, this is the biggest epidemic on the planet. Forget influenza, forget HIV, forget the plague. This is the biggest epidemic because it has gone from zero to basically one-sixth of the world in the span of just 30 years. It is absolutely astounding.
I want to talk a little bit about what's happening to our livers, our children's livers, all of our livers. We know what happens to the livers of alcoholics.
Right.
And we know that sugar is metabolized very similarly to alcohol.
Fructose molecule is.
Yeah, the fructose molecule.
Right.
People don't get arrested for driving under the influence of sugar, but the human liver's metabolism of fructose is remarkably similar to its metabolism of ethanol. Does this mean that fructose is similar to alcohol in how it damages the human liver and how it raises our likelihood of developing associated diseases?
That's exactly what it means. If you look at a liver under the microscope from an alcoholic and from a soda consumer, you can't tell the difference. And we've already done two liver transplants on 400-pound, 15-year-old soda drinkers at UCSF. In fact, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease has now overtaken hepatitis B and C as being the primary cause of liver transplant in the United States. And that is now occurring in children. These are diseases we've never seen before. So, if you look at how the fructose molecule is metabolized, it goes straight to the liver because no other organ in the body can metabolize it because no other organ has the transporter to get it in to metabolize it. It overwhelms the pathways that would normally lead to burning, and you end up with liver fat. Plus, it's not insulin regulated, so insulin can't shut it down. So when you consume a soda, you are flooding your liver with excess energy that goes straight to fat. And we now know that that liver fat that is produced from the sugar, what happens to the sugar in your liver, is what drives all of those other chronic metabolic diseases that we call metabolic syndrome. And you know, it makes sense that this would be true because sugar and alcohol are metabolized virtually identically. And after all, where do you get alcohol from? Fermentation of sugar. It's called wine. You know, we do it in Napa and Sonoma every day. The big difference between alcohol and fructose is that for alcohol, the yeast does the first step of my metabolism called glycolysis. For fructose, we do our own first step. But once the mitochondria in your cells, in your liver, are presented with that excess energy, it only knows one thing to do, and that is take the excess and turn it into liver fat. And the faster that liver fat gets made, the faster it either gets exported, in which case your triglycerides go up, or maybe it doesn't get exported, and it precipitates as a lipid droplet, and now you have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So the two diseases that we have causation for, heart disease and type 2 diabetes, are both based on what the liver does to sugar in terms of its production of fat.
Well, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, I don't think had even been described until 1980. It is really a recent development, at least our recognition of it is. And We know that for most people, there's a threshold beneath which alcohol seems to be safe and may even provide some health benefits.
That's right.
And there are people, though, for whom alcohol just, it's not a slippery slope, it's a cliff. And for them, and you find them in AA, and you sometimes find them with serious, very, very serious health problems, the only safe amount of alcohol is zero.
Right.
Do you think that similarly, there is a threshold for sugar where beneath that amount would be safe for many people, but that for some people, the only safe amount would be something like zero?
Well, I don't know about zero. Zero is probably too strong a number in this case, but each of us has a limited capacity to metabolize fructose. We have the machinery to be able to oxidize it, to basically turn it into energy at a certain point. But different people have different thresholds. And if you go above your individual threshold, your liver has no choice but to turn the excess into fat. And that's where the chronic disease starts. So the question you're really asking is, who are the most susceptible in our society?
Yes.
And who has to be most careful
yes.
about their sugar consumption? That's what I think you're asking.
Yes.
Okay. There are a couple of things that can increase your rate of sugar metabolism in your liver. One of them is exercise. Exercise increases mitochondria across the board, and mitochondria burn energy instead of allowing it to be stored. And it's true even in the liver. So if you exercise a lot, you can consume a greater amount of sugar before you will reach your upper threshold. So if you are a football player on the gridiron for 3 hours a day and you want to drink a Gatorade, that's fine. That's not a problem. But what if you're not? What if you're a mere mortal like me? and you consume that same Gatorade. That excess sugar, which is in the Gatorade, is going to top out your ability to metabolize it, and you're going to drive fatty liver disease. So the question really is, who is the Gatorade marketed to? If it were marketed to athletes, all they'd have to do is basically have the Gatorade tubs at the sporting events for the athletes. No, the Gatorade and all the energy drinks, if you will, are being marketed to children, to be more like an athlete. Well, the fact of the matter is, there is no energy drink that can make you an athlete, period.
That's okay? For sure.
That's just make that very clear.
I want to talk about kids a little more and obesity. You are an internationally renowned pediatric endocrinologist. You've had a front row seat to the declining health of our children. You've pointed out that we even have an epidemic of obese 6-month-olds.
Obese newborns.
Obese newborns. You're also the co-author of a study that I want to talk about. It was published in the medical journal Atherosclerosis, and I find it quite fascinating. I think it's important. In this study, you found that obese children who cut out sugar from their diets saw enormous improvements in cardiovascular risk factors after only 9 days. And the only change was their sugar intake.
Yes, we did take the added sugar out of their diet, but we knew that the big criticism would be, well, of course you took the sugar out of their diet, they got better, because their calories went down. Their weight would have gone down. So we actually, instead, when we took the sugar out of their diet, we replaced it with starch. We gave them the same number of calories, and we gave them an extra molecule that had the exact same caloric value as did sugar at 4.1 calories per gram. We made sure they didn't lose weight because we sent them home with a scale and had them weigh themselves every day. And we call them up and say, what'd you weigh? And if they were losing weight, we said, eat more, because we were controlling for calories and we were controlling for weight. What we saw was absolutely remarkable. Not only did all of their cardiovascular parameters get better, all of their other metabolic parameters, including their glucose tolerance, their insulin sensitivity, and their lactate went down. So we fixed their insulin resistance, we fixed their mitochondria, and we fixed their lipids without changing calories and without losing weight. And we did it in 9 days. I mean, think about that.
I've spoken with many physicians in recent years, and almost all of them say they are becoming convinced by the accumulating science that sugar is much worse than they had thought. I see a real change in thinking occurring. The old paradigm said that the problem with sugar was that it provides empty calories and so contributes to weight gain. But the new understanding is that sugar consumption quite directly, and whether you're fat or not, can contribute to heart disease and heart attacks and diabetes and high blood pressure and cancer. One cardiologist told me, and he's a pretty prominent one, he said, and I quote him, I spent 30 years working as a cardiologist without ever once wondering what impact sugar had on the heart. What would you say to him, Rob, and what would you like him to say to his cardiovascular patients?
Sugar changes heart muscle contractility by causing lipid accumulation in the muscle. So this cardiomyopathy, this heart failure that we're seeing, very well may be related to sugar consumption as well. We don't have the data to prove that yet, but it's certainly looking promising. So this concept that only the liver can metabolize a compound, and when that compound doesn't serve any useful purpose in the body, and when excess consumption of that compound drives different metabolic processes that cause disease. We have a name for that compound. It's called a toxin. That's the definition of toxin. Now, sugar has gotten a free pass because it's calories. And people say, well, you need calories to live. You need energy to live. So here's my question to you. Can you name an energy source which is not food, which is not nutrition, which, when consumed in excess, causes cell and metabolic damage and death, and we love it anyway, and it's addictive? Answer, alcohol. Alcohol is not food. Alcohol is not nutrition. There is no dietitian on the planet who would tell you that alcohol is beneficial or that it is a nutrient. There is no biochemical reaction in any eukaryotic organism on the planet that uses alcohol for energy. Yet, alcohol is considered a toxin. Well, guess what? Sugar meets exactly the same criteria. So we need to look at this molecule in a very different way than we had before. And when you realize that sugar and alcohol are metabolized the same way, and when you realize that a bowl of Fruit Loops and a glass of orange juice constitutes three times the amount that children are supposed to have for the whole day, and it's just breakfast, you can see what's happening. Sugar is the alcohol of the child.
We recognize that alcohol is an addictive substance and that people who become addicted to it have very, very serious health problems, social problems. That's widely recognized. Are you saying then that we should start to think about sugar and particularly its excessive use in children in somewhat the same way as we think about alcohol?
I'm saying exactly that. A little is metabolizable, and a little in general doesn't hurt unless, of course, you're you have an addictive personality for that. But a lot does, and a lot hurts in different ways. Now, the reason why alcohol has such a bad rap, of course, is because of the acute effects, because, you know, of the drunken driving. To be honest with you, alcohol did not have that bad a rap until Mothers Against Drunk Driving made it priority one. Remember, we had prohibition, and it was a complete non-starter. It ultimately had to be repealed. Addictive substances are addictive. You can know all of the things that this substance is doing to you, your health, your life, your family, your community, and your society, and you are powerless to do anything about it. That's the definition of addiction. You know in your conscious mind what's going on, but you can't control it. It controls you. Well, the same thing is happening to sugar in children, and all you have to do is go to the grocery store and watch the kids have the temper tantrums in the aisles when their parents don't buy them the sugared cereals, which are at their eye level.
Well, one of the ways that sugar harms us has to do with belly fat. The human body needs some fat to store energy and for other purposes. But we have a problem with abdominal or visceral or big belly fat, as it can be called.
Well, we think liver fat is even more important. Yes, visceral fat is bad. No argument. What drives visceral fat? Answer, stress. Stress drives visceral fat because cortisol drives visceral fat. What drives liver fat? Sugar. Sugar drives liver fat. And liver fat drives hyperinsulinemia, and hyperinsulinemia drives all of the chronic metabolic diseases. So the question is, which one is more fixable? The visceral fat with stress reduction or the liver fat with sugar restriction? The problem is fixing people's response to stress is extraordinarily difficult. But you could take the sugar out of people's diets and get their liver fat down, and you wouldn't even have to ask them to do anything. All you'd have to do is get the food industry to comply. That's our goal.
Oh, that's all you'd have to do.
That's all we have to do.
As if that was a simple thing. Well, I want to ask you about insulin resistance for a moment. I mean, sure. It's a hallmark of metabolic syndrome. And whatever organ becomes insulin resistant, then that organ will manifest its own metabolic syndrome in effect.
Exactly right.
When you have insulin resistance of the liver, you end up with type 2 diabetes. When you have insulin resistance of the brain, you end up with Alzheimer's disease. When you have insulin resistance of the kidneys, you end up with chronic renal disease. The point I'm trying to make is that all of these conditions typically arise from insulin resistance. So
I completely agree.
The question I want to ask you, Rob, is what causes insulin resistance in the first place?
So you have to understand how insulin works. Insulin has one receptor, the insulin receptor. It binds to that receptor and then transduces two separate signals in the liver and in the muscle. The first signal we call the metabolic signal, the transcription factor is called AKT. And virtually all of the things that AKT controls are, for the most part, beneficial. It basically causes cells to utilize glucose. It causes liver glucose output to go down, which therefore keeps your blood sugar low. It activates the enzymes that cause de novo lipogenesis, that is, you know, fat making to try to export the fat out of the liver as triglyceride, in order to keep your liver healthy. So AKT is kind of a good thing. But the second pathway that insulin stimulates, which is called MAP kinase, is not so good. And what MAP kinase does is it causes cell division, because insulin is a growth factor. Insulin causes cells to divide. And when it causes muscles to divide, it causes vascular smooth muscle hypertrophy, which then puts you at risk for coronary artery disease. It can cause breast cells to hypertrophy, which can then ultimately lead to breast cancer and a host of other phenomena throughout the body where excess insulin drives long-term degenerative and or chronic disease and or cancer and or dementia, like you mentioned. Well, the only goal is to get the insulin down. You got to get the insulin down. And that is what we do in our clinic at UCSF every single day. Our clinic is an insulin reduction clinic to try to improve insulin sensitivity. Now, the low-hanging fruit of improving insulin sensitivity is get rid of the sugar. Why does sugar cause insulin resistance? Well, because sugar is metabolized to fat, and that fat drives that insulin resistance. In addition, there are specific transcription factors that are turned on by fructose in the liver that actually interfere with insulin signaling directly at the receptor and at the substrate that comes after the receptor called IRS1. So everything about sugar makes insulin resistance. And so when we get sugar down in kids' diets, their insulin resistance reverses. And we've shown you can see the effects in 9 days.
I'm hearing you say that getting the insulin down and improving insulin sensitivity is critically
paramount.
Important, and that getting the sugar reduced or out of the diet is the number one way to do that. Is it also important to get more fiber in the diet to improve insulin sensitivity?
Absolutely. And there's a reason for that. So everyone's heard of the microbiome by now. It's, you know, the hottest word around. I think it even made word of the year for Webster's a year or two ago. So the microbiome is your bacteria. So here's how you need to think about this. You consume 160 calories in almonds. Okay, I love almonds. Consume 160 calories in almonds. How many of those calories do you absorb? Turns out only 130. What happened to the other 30? Where'd they go? Turns out the 130 got metabolized up high in the duodenum, but the 30 didn't, because the fiber in the almonds, both soluble and insoluble, formed a gel on the inside of the duodenum, on the inside of the upper intestine, which acted as a secondary barrier. And so those calories did not get absorbed early on. Therefore, it didn't cause the glucose spike. It didn't have to be handled by the liver. It didn't drive an insulin response because they're still in the intestine. So the food moves further down the intestine to the jejunum, the next part of the intestine. And what lives there? Well, the microbiome. That's where the microbiome is. Why isn't the microbiome in the duodenum? The answer is because the pH just changed because of the stomach. The stomach contents are pH 1. No bacteria except H. pylori can live in pH of 1. And the sphincter of Oddi, which is where the pancreas exits into the intestine, you know, is kind of in the mid-duodenum. And so, basically, it doesn't mix with the food contents until the jejunum, and that's where the bacteria are. So those 30 calories in the almonds that you didn't absorb in your duodenum because of the fiber went to the jejunum, and then the bacteria got it. So even though you consumed it, you didn't absorb it. Therefore, you didn't get it. When you fed yourself those almonds, you didn't just feed yourself. You fed your bacteria, and that's a good thing to do because your bacteria are, you know, a host of hundreds, even thousands of different species. So when you feed your bacteria, you're allowing the fragile bacteria to sort of offset the bad bacteria, what's known as microbial diversity. And that's associated with metabolic health by keeping the bad bacteria at bay. So when you consume food with fiber, you're not getting all the calories you ate, which is why a calorie is not a calorie, because you only measure what you ate, what passed your lips. What you really need to measure is what passes your intestine, and we don't have any rational way of doing that. But knowing that 25 to 30% of the calories you consume actually go to your bacteria means the calories are crap.
Does it also mean that, I'm thinking about the difference between soluble and insoluble fiber.
Well, they're both important.
They're both important.
And most real food has both. So for the audience, soluble fiber is like pectins, like what holds jelly together. Insoluble fiber is like the stringy stuff in celery, the cellulose, the, the green stuff. Most real food that has not been processed contains both forms. And what happens is, think of the hair catcher on your bathtub drain. It's a little plastic doohickey that has holes in it, right? And when you take a shower, the hair gets caught on the drain, plugs the holes, and then you have to clean it, you know, in order for it to catch hair again and, allow the water to go down in the bathtub. So the insoluble fiber forms the latticework like the plastic, and the soluble fiber forms, plugs those holes like the hair does. And so what you end up with when you have both is an insoluble barrier, and that's good, and that's what you want to happen. Now, the food industry has caught on to this fiber craze, and so what they're doing is they're adding soluble fiber only back to food.
Like psyllium.
Like psyllium, exactly, and other forms as well. Inulin and other forms of soluble fiber. The point is that you can't make that lattice work without the insoluble fiber, and no one's figured out how to add insoluble fiber back to food yet.
So it means we should get our fiber from food.
That's right. That's what it means.
Well, it seems to me that fiber...
real food.
It's sometimes called roughage or bulk, but it's a really misunderstood weapon in our nutritional arsenal.
I think fiber is the key to the kingdom. I think that fiber is the thing we are not getting. And people think fiber is what you throw in the garbage after you juice the orange. As far as I'm concerned, the fiber was the reason to eat the orange in the first place.
Wow. Well,
you have to rethink, what you're doing.
Rob, I want to shift a little bit. You're obviously a scientist. Typically, scientists see their role as generating data and researching issues, and then And then most scientists more or less expect that our public health officials and our elected officials will use that data and those research findings to improve the public good in some way. And maybe that was once the case, but it really isn't now for many reasons, most of them involving money.
Yes.
Do you think at this point that some scientists need to get involved in public policy issues and even legal challenges?
Absolutely. You know, I entered medicine back in the ivory tower era, you know, where the scientists did the science and then the public policy makers used that science to advance specific social agendas. That's what used to happen. That stopped about 40 years ago. And there are many reasons why it stopped, but most of them having to do with money, as you said, having to do with payoffs to individual congressmen and other local officials to ignore the science because whatever that science was generating was not good for their industry. That's basically what has happened. Jeremiah Stamler, the father of cardiovascular epidemiology, famously said once, "If a scientist is not willing to follow his data into the policy arena, who will?" I took that very personally. I also took personally a statement made at an Indian public health forum back about 10 years ago called the Hyderabad Statement, which says, "All significant public health changes involve and require the use of law." And that's why I went to law school. I went and got a master's in law at University of California Hastings College of the Law so that I understood what public health law was about, what it could do, what the obstacles were, what the legal doctrines were, and we are figuring out how to apply those doctrines to fix this obesity, diabetes, fatty liver disease, cardiovascular disease, metabolic syndrome pandemic. And it's working.
A number of our speakers in this and our other Food Revolution summits, including Mark Bittman and Michael Pollan, have been quite vocal about calling for a national food policy. And that's one of our goals here at the Food Revolution Network, too, is a national food policy. Your nonprofit, the Institute for Responsible Nutrition, is participating in that discussion. Can you tell us about the Institute and its projects?
Yes, well, we have lots to announce as well. We have just merged with a like-minded nonprofit known as the United States Healthful Food Council. And so IRN and USHFC have now merged to form a joint entity, which is now known as Eat Real. And Eat Real, the real part is in capitals because it's an acronym. It stands for Responsible Epicurean and Agricultural Leadership. When we read through their mission and their strategies, it was exactly ours. What they had developed was a scoring system and a labeling system for restaurants called REAL Certified. And again, REAL being the acronym. And you can see it in certain restaurants around the country even today. And you'll note it with a green fork in the center of the logo. And so we were developing exactly the same thing for packaged foods. A front of package label that would tell people in the grocery store, what's in this package can't kill you because it's real. And we are having those discussions with various states, various departments of health. For instance, the state of Tennessee has already signed on. We will be approaching another state very, very soon. And we hope to basically make this something that people will want, because it's ultimately good for them. And we already know that certain restaurants want it because they can then distinguish themselves from their competitors and people who are, you know, interested in caring for themselves and caring for their health will actually frequent those restaurants.
And this will give them an easy tool to be able to identify which foods are actually caring for their health and which ones are not.
That's the idea. Since we can't expect anything from Washington, because, after all, you know, the U.S. Department of Agriculture is just the mouthpiece of the food industry and the FDA is the mouthpiece of the drug industry, this is going to have to come from another venue. And ultimately, Washington is going to have to be dragged along kicking and screaming, which means we have to create the demand for it at the local level. And that's what we're doing.
Well, it's what we're doing here, too, at the Food Revolution Network, and I, why we feel such an alliance with you and respect for what you're doing. It's one of the central tenets of the work we do that food should confer wellness, not illness. you know, Rob, I want to thank you for being one of our most trustworthy leaders and guides in the food revolution.
Hey, I'm a pediatrician. You know, our children are our future. And if our children are getting sick, we have no future.
I once saw a child wearing a T-shirt that said, "If you love me, don't feed me junk food."
That's right. That's right.
Well, thank you for being with us today, Rob, and thank you for your leadership in so many ways, and thank you for being part of with us of the Food Revolution.
Oh, it's my pleasure, John. Really, pleasure to talk with you.
We've been talking with pediatric endocrinologist and public health advocate Dr. Robert Lustig, board member of the United States Healthful Food Council, which you can find at eatreal.org, and author of Fat Chance, The Hidden Truth About Sugar, Obesity, and Disease. Dr. Lustig, your research is thorough and your findings are profoundly significant. We want to thank you for your advocacy, for your brilliant leadership, and for your partnership in the food revolution.
Well, thank you for your advocacy and your leadership and your partnership as well. This is a global problem and it's going to take all of us to solve it.
Indeed it is, and we're doing it together.
Thank you.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and you want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 24 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then check this out. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus ebooks, courses, trainings, recipes, and videos. And this empowerment package is available for a huge 50% discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thank you so much for joining us in the Food Revolution.